It's the other thing I wanted to just comment on is, because we said that and I'll be up for discussion. So with regards to the presentations yesterday and you know, assessing the effects on the wild fish, as I said, and I know I sound like a broken record here, but there's some key information that's been missed in this Chinook risk assessment. One basically is the freshwater life history stage for the yearling populations, and there's all major lakes that have big streams coming in them have stream type fish. These fish reside in the freshwater for at least a year before they migrate. I believe they migrate earlier, so they have a different behavior of maybe not spending as much time in the estuary and moving off. So this component is being, I feel it's being missed in the encapsulation of limiting factors in regards to feeding, feed and as the fish hit the ocean, because they are, I would have to say, a different freshwater life stage that behaves differently and may have a different migrational pattern. The stream tech fish that are in the upper reaches where the water is 25% colder and they are only coming out of the gravel in April, May at a half a gram. Of course, they are now feeding in the lakes. So there's that food topic on those fish. And the other thing I wanted to comment on is, I know we keep on referring to that the Chinook took a downturn in the 98 or whatever, but if you look at the information, historical information, overfishing by 1950 had already greatly declined a lot of the Chinook populations. Then the fishing continued from 1950 to 79, where we harvested, by 1979, we were at 2 million Chinook being harvested that originated from Canadian streams. At the same time, there was surveys in BC of 120 streams from 1950 to 1979, and the escapement dropped by 50%, and the report said, how much longer can these Chinook populations weather this fishing pressure? Then we have, habitat loss. So we're putting together this risk assessment on the assumption that the Chinook populations were never really that big, that they don't have, they're all ocean type. We need to have the foundational information part of the discussion from the beginning going into this, because it's like building a house. If you build it on pickup sticks, eventually the whole thing's going to tumble down. So we need to include the foundational basic information. And I know that EFO says, well, we read all the scale samples, they're all ocean type. But there, if you go into the field and you see, okay, the fish are a half a gram in the gravel coming out right now, but hey, there's 3 gram fish. You got two age classes. And so there is reading scale samples from adult fish to determine freshwater duration is a interpretation tool. The interpretation tool is written, it has inaccuracies. And so we need to set that aside and go back to saying, the fish are coming out of the gravel at a half gram. Ron Tanasichuk's information, if you look at his fish sizes, the wild fish are the same size as the hatchery fish that have been fed on fish food for 3 months to get them to 3 and 5 grams. So you're looking, what are you looking at when you look at Ron Tanasichuk's sampling data? Are they ocean type or are they stream type? So, and yes, I know, Dave, there is isotope analysis, but you're still looking at otoliths and you're still looking. So you simply got to go into the field and say, okay, what do we know for certain? We know they spawn in October, the adults. We know the water temperature. We know if the ATU profiling, we know they're coming out of the gravel when between 980 and 1118. Now we know that fish is this size. So sorry to lecture everybody on this, but if we want to determine the you know, this risk assessment and come up with the solution, we need to incorporate all this information into the discussion and not just ocean tight. We come out there at the estuary and they hang along shore. As Jim Irving said, what do we know about the stream type larger fish? You know, where do they go? Rapidly go, maybe they're off the shelf. Here's a data gap that should be looked at and incorporated, because the fish that are spawning in the colder reaches in the upper systems like Kennedy, Great Central, Sproat, you name it, Henderson, those will be our fish of the future. As climate warms, these streams are still cool. The fish are in the lakes as a nursery lake, and they migrated earlier, it's my take on things. So back to doing this risk assessment right now, how are we going to backtrack or get this also into the conversation where this information has yet to be presented? So sorry about that, but just food for thought.
Yeah, thanks, Gail. Wilf or Jim, do you have any comments on that before we move forward?
We need to have a conversation. You know, we've gone through these conversations. I'm not sure they're very productive. There's something in the chat there from Dave. We've done a lot of work to try and, you know, we're not saying there are no stream type fish on the West Coast main crown, but the predominant life history is the ocean type, and that's what we're working on here. There may be stream type fish. We're not sure how genetically distinct they are. See them every once in a while, but they're definitely not the predominant fish, Chinook, that we see. As we went through, based on the habitat, were there hundreds of thousands of fish before? No. We figure, based on habitat capacity, that the natural production could have been in the order unfished in the order of 75,000. And so we're at 20,000 or so now. We know we need to build that 20,000 up. We need to improve our genetic diversity of the ocean type fish, but also not ignore the fact that there's a lot of benefit from the hatchery fish that are out there as well, that has produced returns of 300,000 plus fish. So we're trying to find out, how do we rebuild the ocean type? If there are, that's a separate question. We can go look at that. But there's enough science out there that we are not mistaking our ocean type fish for our stream type fish for ocean type fish. And we are even doing more work. There are, I've got the data here from the Sarita River and Bob's on, I saw. And so they've been sampling all the way through. You can see this is 3 years of Sarita River downstreams from, you know, early February through into June, that when these fish are coming out, 50% time, how much variation there is, and the size. This is 40 millimeters here, you know, under a gram, and you can see them growing. And so there are a few fish coming out later, but they're growing in size. And so we've done analysis. There's all kinds of work that we've done that show that these are ocean type fish.
Well, I would like to present all the information from my many years of field work. I lost everybody there for a minute. And I just ran into Danny Lee the other day. He's probably about 80 years old. And he was just telling me about, he worked on a seine boat, and they captured the Nimint Chinook in the Nimint Bay in 1947. He says the whole bay was full of fish. The seiner was so full of fish, it took 3 days to offload them at the cannery. At the time, I think Inuchuk was still operational. But back to the... Their information is incorrect, because the stream type fish are only 3 grams, 2, 3, 4 grams coming out in May or April, May. And yet, you know, all of Ron's fish that he caught for his sampling in the Alberni, and they're all the larger fish. And so back to, I know DFO is defensive about the ocean type, but I can tell you that for the predominant life history is a large percentage of stream type. And so back to, yes, I'd like the opportunity to present this information, and that it should be part of the discussion when we're trying to come up with a recovery plan for Chinook. And the department's saying there's very few. I'm saying that there's way more than we think. And so, first of all, the information has to be presented so that we can then move forward from that.
Thanks, Gail. I would venture to say that we're probably not going to be sort of altering the model that we're using for life history within this workshop based on this conversation. I'm going to invite that, you know, perhaps that conversation happens further and can continue offline. We've certainly heard that you want the opportunity to be able to present the information, and I think that discussion is going on in some other places. So, you know, this venue here probably isn't the place where we're going to have some sort of resolution to that conversation.
Opportunity to present the information should be, because we are talking about Chinook, West Coast, Vancouver Island, and there's been a lot of presentations about other information.
The presentations have been topic specific as we've been going on, and we do sort of understand and hear that you wanted that opportunity, and the conversation about it is sort of happening away from the workshop directly. So, you know, I appreciate you bringing up the information for sure. But just saying that conversation will have to happen offline away from this workshop.
Not from this workshop today, but I'm saying that we need to have a workshop as part of the Chinook risk assessment to review this information and integrate it. And this workshop was supposed to be not just federal, you know, DFO's information, and, you know, it's supposed to be community, it's supposed to be, you know, a consortium of information from everyone. And the fact that it hasn't so far been included, it is somewhat of a disservice to the Chinook risk assessment that's supposed to be, you know, having all this information come in. And so hopefully a future presentation will, a time slot will be allowed to present this information and the importance of it for rebuilding the West Coast Vancouver Island Chinook runs. And that's the ultimate objective of everybody spending all these hours for this.
Thanks, Carol. Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time studying Chinook in my career, and I'm, you know, I guess somewhat sympathetic to what Carol's saying, and you know, I guess my background tells me that these are not stream type Chinook. It's not a stream type Chinook area, but I think that we have to acknowledge that there are data gaps with respect to monitoring the in-stream populations of Chinook, and probably particularly some of the historical information is not as comprehensive as it should be. So I do think that we have to, you know, in whatever report comes out of this, we have to acknowledge the fact that there is some uncertainty as to the you know, historical importance or significance of stream type Chinook in these watersheds, and if there are data out there that might be useful, that they should be examined. You know, whether it's part of this process or not, I don't know. But you know, it's difficult to know what you know, what was out there 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and I'd like to look at the, you know, the size information from Tanasichuk's work. I mean, if the fish were larger, you know, I didn't see any data in Ron's presentation yesterday. I just, you know, it was just sort of summary statistics. But, you know, if the fish were larger, what was the time of year? Does that correspond with, you know, growth within Barkley Sound of ocean-type fish? Or if they were large early? You know, I mean, there's a big difference between an ocean-type fish that spent a year in freshwater and comes out as a smolt versus even a 90-day wonder that comes out as an ocean-type fish, right? So you should be able to differentiate the two. So anyway, I think it's an information gap that we need to recognize.
And I just want to say that, Jim, I do have the information. I spent 18 years, I've grown Chinook for 40 years, okay? Federal hatcheries, private hatcheries. I've got 18 years of field data from all the streams on Great Central Lake. I've been up to Clemens Creek. There were Chinook there that were photo in September. It was about a 1.5 gram Chinook. So, you know, the information is there to demonstrate that these fish are in the system. And when I first started this, you know, the department said, well, Carol, under wild salmon policy, we're obligated to grow a fish that mimics Mother Nature, a 3 to 5 gram fish that leaves the system in May out of the fresh water. I said, those are S1s because the wild fish are only coming out of the gravel at 0.5 gram in April and May. And if you look at the mint, temperature profile and all this stuff, so this needs to be presented to the Chinook Risk Assessment Workshop as part of the discussion. And this has been an uphill battle because the entire department has put all these hatcheries together that grow S0 type Chinook, and it's you know.
You know, I think Wilf has put a comment in the chat, and I think it's appropriate that I think you know, if you have the information, I think we need to meet with you and look at the data. You know, I think that's fair.
I think it should be part of the information transfer and discussion for the risk assessment workshops. It's not no backyard, we're going to talk to you about it. That's what's already happened. You know, let me present all this information so that we can, you know, have all the other experts on this committee and discussions think for themselves and say, okay, well, wow, you know, okay, we need to manage for this freshwater life stage as well. It should not be an uphill battle to try and to have information integrated to the Chinook risk assessment process on fish that are related to the West Coast Vancouver Island Chinook.
Okay, Carol, thank you. We are going to have to move on from the conversation now. We're now sort of approaching time, and in the interest of time, going to have to move on to the next subject, but thanks for bringing it up, and you know, we can continue the conversation offline after this specific workshop. Okay, maybe we'll move on to Tim. Tim was going to walk us through the scoring procedure that we will be using to rank the 4 limiting factors that we had presented for this workshop. So Tim, why don't you go ahead?
Hey, Mark, maybe just back to you. We have scheduled a 10:30 break. That's 10 minutes. Maybe we want to spend the 10 minutes before that talking about any sort of other key knowledge gaps. And then what I'm planning on doing is walking everyone here through the online forms that we've prepared for collecting your information on scoring. So I'd rather not start that right before a break.
Sure, Jackie, go ahead.
Sorry, I shouldn't have wrote. I raised my hand just a little too early because I kind of thought maybe you'd go, okay, let's keep talking about that. I'm just looking for a little bit of guidance, I guess, particularly based on maybe what people might have done in previous workshops when it comes time to scoring at the 50-year projection. And there I'm only asking because we didn't really see any modeling exercises, you know, projecting, let's say, herring or euphausid biomass into the future, or connecting these things to climate change. What are you looking for? How are people going to try to take a guess of, you know, what will be the quality of prey 50 years from now? What are people going to do, or what have they done in the past? Because to me, being able to make a projection into, you know, 50 years into the future, well, we should have been looking at a few model projections.
Pass it over to you and Tim as well.
Yeah, that's a great question, Jackie. We're right now is quite qualitative. If our uncertainty is high, what you're saying, we know we should have some of these model projections built, then that would come out. In the meantime, hopefully we've got people like Akash here, yourself, that what would these populations look like, and you know, with plankton, are going to have more southern versus northern, what do we think is going? So it's been pretty qualitative with, as Isabel was showing, that we would say there's potentially that there's a knowledge gap here, and we would look for support to be done. And then
So you can just take a good guess, but rate your confidence as low.
Yep.
Okay.
No, you're an expert. We have the experts here. This is a technical work.
Oh, that's don't. Okay. Experts that have provided qualitative indication, but never once did you ask me to provide any sort of 50-year projections on any of this, nor did you attach. So there is a big difference between quantitative and qualitative, and I'm okay with qualitative, but don't try to say Jackie King has provided some sort of expertise in what the prey quality will be 50 years from now. I was happy with just the take your best guess and rate your confidence in that guess.
Yep.
Okay.
And that's where we had gone, Jackie, in the past. If Isabel had a good synopsis at the beginning to get a sense of what's happening to populations of interest in a data deficient situation, that is where some of that qualitative looking at things comes in. And certainly with the future without those models present. We do want to note, though, as Will said, those data gaps and priorities for research. Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that the risk assessment methodology for salmon process sort of incorporates that uncertainty into it. So the confidence score that we're going to attempt to attribute to each score is for the present risk rating. I think we know that for almost everything we're rating in freshwater and marine risk assessment, we have enormous uncertainty about what the next 50 years looks like. And so it is sort of a best guess. It's a pretty subjective or qualitative prediction. And it sort of builds in that inherently, this is the low confidence exercise to predict in the future. But we're going to try to do that anyways to try and inform and sort of flag for the rebuilding process where we might want to address effort where we see things having the potential to be worse in the future.
Yes, go ahead, Sarah.
Appreciate it. This has been very informative, and I guess it sort of seems to be the classic high-level academic and then the sort of like boots on the ground. I've been doing this for, you know, however long, 80 years, my entire lifetime. I can tell a fish is ripe when just by looking at it, you know, like these sort of like the more salty observations that happen over time instead of the sort of data and graphs. And I just sort of want to reflect, because I'm not coming to this as a DFO expert. You know, I sit on the watershed board for the Nootka Sound, and I'm an elected official, so I come at it from a zero knowledge of science basis. I come at it as public opinion, and I think that there's definitely some concerns, like Jackie was saying, about, you know, the groceries or the food for our food in 50 years. And I think too that with the very first day yesterday, when we were talking about how, you know, in my region there's the Canuma strays and they go to all the other wild salmon streams and they outcompete them, and you know how the long-term effects of bringing, you know, fish protein from the global south and then making it into a fish meal to feed our hatchery fish here in the north, and then how that has ripple effects to Alaska, you know, like there's definitely a lot of context that is kind of missing from the general scientific graphs. And, you know, like, I don't mean to be always the dumbest person in the room or on any call, but I do see how, like, I know that there's a sea lice workshop coming up that is being offered to people, I guess, through the watershed board that I'm involved in. And I see how that is one of the, yes, it's a natural thing that occurs. It happens in bees too. There's varroa mites, there's pathogens. And I think that how we're moving fish protein from somewhere else to feed and enhance our hatchery fish here, and how that creates like bigger sort of swirls in the ecosystem, and how it's being received by the public, right? You know, like that is at the end, you know, if we're citizen scientists, then we're sort of on our own, making our own conclusions. But if we're DFO scientists, then we are funded by public dollars. So I think that there is some kind of like, hope or expectation that we have to start at the ground and build understanding from that level. And I know that tomorrow we're doing a beach seining here in Nootka Sound at Tassis. And one of the things, you know, we weigh the fish, the small fish, we see if there's like groceries or other sort of food products that would be for the hatchery fish, but also for the wild fish. We just sort of do an assessment. We see how many green crabs there are, predators, these kinds of things. And I find that this is a volunteer-run organization that is doing this citizen science. And there's definitely a lot of, you know, dragging it to the bottom so that people can understand, instead of having this really high-level decision-making, which sometimes, in my opinion, is over my head at least. But of course, the more I learn, the more I know, the more I know what I don't know. But thank you so much. It's been really informative. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to put it back down.
Did you have another comment there?
No, I was just trying to put my hand back down. Sorry about that. I struggle with things that are too complicated for me. You can clearly see that.
Like yours.
And as Wilf was talking about this process being fairly qualitative in nature earlier, I mean, the objective here in going through these surveys, which we're doing after the break, and the way that they've been set up, the way that the risk assessment methodology is set up, is to have a process that both takes in sort of academic or government science as well as community information and local expertise in a way that that we can keep track of. And so that's our objective here. There's by no means a perfect way of doing that, but this is probably a challenge for everyone involved. But hopefully by doing it and meeting somewhere in the middle of a lot of different knowledge systems, we can come out with a product that serves to meet that middle.
Great, that's a good segue. Perhaps maybe we can take our break now. We were scheduled for 10:30. Why don't we take a 15-minute break, come back at 10:45, and we can look at the forms and how we're going to do this group risk rating and go forward from there. So 15 minutes and we'll be back at 10:45. Thanks, everybody.
So for my break on this Vancouver Island West Coast Chinook full day, two full days of learning about how one system feeds into another, I am going to read a bit of this book that my lovely friend and neighbor, Jess Esslinger, she's left now. She's gone back to Quebec, and so she left this book, The Power of Pulses, Dan Jason, Hillary Malone, and Allison Malone Eathorn. Saving the World with Peas, Beans, Chickpeas, Favas, and Lentils includes 50 vegetarian recipes. So, this is a recipe book, and also, it is, for anyone who doesn't know Dan Jason, he is the Salt Spring Seed Guy, and today, later on today at 11:30, so in an hour, we're having the first meeting of the Vancouver Island Food Shed with Arzina Hamir and Ben Isett and myself, Sarah Fowler. You're listening to Sarah Fowler at the Green Antler in Tassus. And, you know, this food, whether it's West Coast Chinook, what Chinook eat, who eats the Chinook, whether it's killer whales or us, how we enhance them with our salmon hatcheries, with our efforts, our human efforts, how we recognize there's other creatures that are, you know, pinnipeds or orca whales or however everything fits in together. I think that being on the West Coast and being part of the ring of fire of that is the Pacific is there's a lot of moving parts. It's like the most complicated clock you've ever seen. And so I tend to take it down to the ground and down to the land and how we can actually do that. But I also know that Arzina Hamir, who farms in the Murville, in the Comox Valley, who's going to be on my call later with the food shed, Vancouver Island Food Shed, she has brought to the attention of the regional district there, the Comox Valley Regional District, is the, you know, you can't grow pulses without water. So it's also measuring those needs. And they mentioned this in the Chinook talk too about how, you know, do we know if there's going to be enough food, like baby jellyfishes or larvae or whatever it is they say that is in the stomachs of the West Coast Chinook. Do we know if what those projections are? So, you know, we know that water use, it rains a lot here, but we don't really catch the rain. We tend to just let that flush out and then have wells and also run of the river sort of surface water. And I know that last summer there was a few people who I know who farm on the Sunshine Coast or who grow things on the Sunshine Coast who their gardens went completely dry because they were not able to water their gardens because of water restriction because too much hot, not enough wet. So that's the thing about how climate change is affecting more than one thing, not only the food for the Chinook, but also the water to grow our pulses. So with organic gardening, easy grow advice, and 50 recipes, dedication, this book is dedicated to all the lovers of the land. And we've got contents, acknowledgements, breakfast recipes. I'll just gonna read the preface. Oh no, acknowledgement. Special acknowledgement to Carol Pope. Thank you, Carol, for encouraging me to write this book. Thank you for your awesome editing and writing skills and for your friendliness and respectfulness throughout the process. Special thank you to Hillary Malone and Allison Malone Eathorn for the fabulous recipes they contributed to this book. Dan Jason. To our mother, Lorna, for encouraging us to play in the kitchen since we were old enough to hold a whisk. Your unwavering support of our culinary adventures means the world to us, Hillary Malone and Allison Malone Eathorn. Preface. As a longtime food gardener, I've prided myself on trying to grow just about everything worth coaxing out of the ground for the kitchen table. So I was surprised to discover from Dan Jason, a lifelong food activist, best-selling author, and founder of Salt Spring Seeds, that I had completely missed out on the delicious and diverse family of pulses. Who knew that through my garden in gorgeous tangles of tresselized blooms in pink striped or purple pods, I could grow a treasure trove of beans, peas, chickpeas, favas, and lentils. Yet my spring and summer garden now abounds with pulses, black and white orca beans, blue pod desiree peas, black beluga lentils, chestnut chickpeas, and crimson flowered favas. Who knew the garden grown pulses have an unforgettable fresh taste and creamy texture? And who knew that whatever they grow, that wherever they grow, these drought-resistant, super-easy dynamos pump nitrogen into the soil, leaving it healthier and more fertile than before. It's no wonder that the United Nations General Assembly has named 2016 the International Year of Pulses. Thanks to their durability, ultralight ecological footprint, and long-lasting benefits to the earth, these hardy, bountiful, and remarkably nourishing ancient crops are now lauded as the food of the future. Noted as a vital source of plant-based proteins and amino acids for people around the globe, the UN recommends pulses be eaten regularly to prevent and help manage chronic diseases such as diabetes, coronary conditions, and cancer. And whenever you grow your own from scratch or source them from your local market, pulses are amazingly versatile in the kitchen. Award-winning recipe developers and best-selling authors Hillary Malone and Allison Malone Eathorn have cooked up a storm of sumptuous ways to eat pulses every day, with starters like soca tart with olive tapenade and tasty main dishes like crispy chickpea power bowl with tahini dressing and fava bean and artichoke tagliatelle. There's even dessert too, from spiced navy bean pumpkin pie with pecan streusel to black bean brownies with espresso ganache. All in all, this beautiful book will help you celebrate the International Year of Pulses in style and leave you inspired, well-fed, and well-nourished. Bon appetit, Carol Pope, Associate Editor. Introduction. I have been growing and talking about the value of pulses, dry peas, and beans, chickpeas, favas, and lentils for 30 years and remain more convinced than ever that they could help renew the health of the planet. Pulses are tried and true. People in temperate climates have been growing and eating them for more than 10,000 years. Nutritional powerhouses, pulses are still the most essential part of the diet of billions of people worldwide. Belonging to the amazing and prolific legume plant family, Leguminaceae or Fabaceae. Sorry, my Latin's not very good. Pulses can snatch nitrogen out of the air and add it to the earth. Because of this powerful ability to increase the fertility of soil by simply growing in it, they are the epitome of renewable energy. Easy to grow and prepare, Dry peas and beans, chickpeas, favas, and lentils can be cooked in a seemingly infinite variety of simple and delicious ways and offer much culinary delights because of their diverse tastes and textures. Cultures around the world have created special dishes for all the pulses, and this book contains 50 inspired recipes that borrow from the best of them. The surprising news is that even though most North Americans don't know beans about beans, our farmers grow vast acreages of pulses to export to millions of people who do appreciate them. And while Canada is the world's largest exporter of pulses, Canadians consume less than 10% of what farmers grow. It's time for Canadians and Americans to realize that pulses, flexible enough to be prepared in hundreds of memorable ways for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, could and should constitute a much larger portion of our daily diet. And in addition to buying pulses from our local farmers, we can grow them ourselves easily and organically. For all the thousands of years seeds have been handed from farmer to farmer, it's only in the past 50 or so that poisons have been used to grow food. We are at a crucial moment in our story when it is absolutely vital that we return to feeding everyone with clean food and water instead of continuing to play havoc with the health and well-being of ourselves and all the Earth's creatures. Pulses can be easily grown without herbicides and pesticides if we size down the North American model of industrial agriculture. To this day, millions of small farmers grow beans without chemicals, and I have been growing beans myself successfully for 30 years without ever resorting to poisons. Pulses are also light on water, increasingly important on this planet where drought is becoming more and more a daily concern. Being the nutrient-dense and easy-to-grow foods that they are, pulses can point us in the direction of a safe and sustainable agriculture that gives everyone access to clean food and water, along with the possibility of living in health, harmony, and mutual benefit. Renewable energy is everywhere, every day, for the celebrating. Pulse plants can show the way by enabling humans to be renewed by our daily food. Like the pulses within our bodies, they are slow and deep and at the heart of things. Pulses require between 20 to 40 times less fossil fuels to produce than meat, yet they provide incredible nourishment. And meanwhile, these same pulses regenerate our earth, nourish the soil that nourishes our food. I hope this book shows how much power there can be in a handful of beans and how much delight there is to be had in growing and cooking pulses. Dan Jason. So I'm probably going to call this episode Magic Beans. Chapter 1, Saving the World with Peas, Beans, Chickpeas, Favas, and Lentils. It's inspiring to think that pulses have been around for more than 10,000 years, and what that actually means, pulses are seeds and foods simultaneously. They have been passed on from hand to hand, farmer to farmer, generation to generation, for all that time. They have never stopped being alive, or we wouldn't be growing them now. The Year of Pulses, Top 5 Picks. In the year 2016 was designated the International Year of Pulses by the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization. The term pulse refers to legumes harvested primarily for their dry seed. This excludes green beans and green peas, both considered vegetables, and also I'm gonna turn this down for a minute. There we go. So where was I? Okay. Green peas, both considered vegetables, also omits clovers and alfalfa, which are mainly used as cover crops. Also not included are soybeans and peanuts, which have a much higher oil content. Pulses contain virtually no fat. For this book, I have focused on 5 pulse crops that grow best in North America and which I am the most familiar with. There are lots of other pulses, including lima, mung, and tepary beans, cowpeas and pigeon peas that prefer summers hotter than we have in most of Canada and the United States, including where I grow them on Salt Spring Island, British Columbia. Although all pulses offer much to celebrate, dry peas and beans, chickpeas, favas, and lentils really stand out for their amazing track record and ease of cultivation. They are the five most important pulse crops and feature prominently in the traditional cuisines of virtually every region of the globe. Accelerated climate change has led to a lot of talk about saving our world. There seems to be a big upsurge of thinking and wondering if it could be possible. I'm writing this to make my case for pulses being key to finding that answer. What would happen if we dropped the kill your enemy syndrome we've got going now, the one we've always had on this planet, and replace it with there are no enemies approach? If everyone got together and thought about how we could all live peacefully with each other, wouldn't the starting point be how we are going to get enough food to eat and clean water for all? What a promising new beginning we would have if we actually figured that out. Pulses are protein-rich superfood that can be grown organically anywhere using very little water and boosting soil wherever they take root. Delicious, versatile, and easy to store, they are perfect food for this planet and all its people. To my mind, the pulse foods are waving at us beckoningly, saying, "You figured us out 10,000 years ago, you figured us out 8,000, 6,000, 4,000, 2,000 years ago, and you're figuring us out now." Healthy pulses, healthy planet. Pulses are actually coming on stronger than ever and are outstanding seeds for our future. Canadian farmers are proclaiming that the prairies, despite already being the world's largest pulse exporter, could grow enough pulses to feed another billion people. Galen Weston, the chief of Canada's largest food retailer, Loblaws, calls pulses the food of the future and a key to keeping populations fed. And, of course, the United Nations has given pulses the top honor and designated 2016 the International Year of Pulses in recognition of their crucial role they play in the future of our Earth. Not only are pulses the best food to weave together all the other foods we have to eat, they offer the potential to weave together a healthy planet for all. But we can't keep on growing pulses with poisons, and we can't continue to endorse the agriculture, an agriculture that relies on poisons. We have to stop swallowing this ludicrous propaganda that the foods we eat need herbicides and pesticides to be grown successfully. Pulses are healthiest without poisons. People are too. I happened on a newspaper editorial that was trying to account for an alarming increase in stomach, gut, and bowel problems in the North American population in the past few decades. It's no mystery to me and to a lot of other people why so many Canadians and Americans are so sick these days. I believe strongly that this is the result of herbicides such as glyphosate, more commonly known as Roundup, being on virtually everything we eat. From keen observation over a 30-year period, I'd say that the growth in these human health issues has paralleled agriculture's increasingly use of poison on enemy weeds and pests. I believe that the residues of herbicides and pesticides disrupt and abort the very complex interactions that go on inside the human body, and they can do so even in very minute doses. Thus, I feel sure this is one of the key reasons for a huge upsurge over the last couple decades in celiac, Crohn's, and Alzheimer's diseases, as well as many other cancers. Oh, how long? Okay. I'm not the only one who feels strongly about this. Dr. Thierry Vrain, a retired genetic engineer and soil biologist with Agriculture Canada, made a cross-Canada tour to speak about engineered food and its impact on human health, presenting strong evidence to back up his concern that due to the prevalence of Roundup Ready crops, and I'll just say also that in my area, their provincial government is allowing the spraying of glyphosate or Roundup in the Crownland to stifle things that challenge challenge the food, the, no, not the food, because there's not, we don't grow food here, we grow timber, we grow wood, and some wood is better than other wood, and it's the same poison your enemy kind of tactics, which I'm seeing on the forestry tech. I've worked in forestry, I've planted trees before, and I've been on a block where when it's been sprayed to keep down other vegetation like salmon berries and etc., we're seeing a lot of stressed plants that put out seed, like fruit, and they are stressed because they are being poisoned, so that the crop that they want to harvest, which is generally pine or spruce in the interior and cedar here on the island, is being targeted as the one that we want, and everything else is we're at war with. And I think that this is what he's talking about having a need to change the approach. So I'm going to come back to the Chinook talk, and I'm going to put a pin in glyphosate and Roundup Ready, and we'll probably come back to that at another time.
So do we think that this is a stable, or do we think it's possibly decreasing or increasing in risk? And so we're going to be going through these, and then the next question here is the confidence or data ability. So with respect to this above scoring matrix that you had, where you input spatial, temporal, impact, and trend scores, how do we feel about the data that are available that informed how you made those assessments? And so a low confidence would be that the data exist but are considered poor, conflicting, or there's just no data about this, we're really just guessing, or that there's substantial disagreement among experts on this particular topic. So a medium confidence would be that some data exists, but there are gaps, or there's some disagreement between experts. And a high confidence would just be that the data exists, they're considered sound, or there's consensus between a bunch of different experts, or just that the risk is constrained by logical consideration. So this is mostly for factors that we consider. We know this is a low risk, and we know it's a low risk because there's really no way we can foresee this being a high risk. Or maybe it's the other way around, we just know it's a high risk because of what we understand about the ecosystem. And so if you, on the above question, answered a low or medium confidence, one of the things we're trying to understand is where do community members and researchers think that we have sort of priority for further research? And so if we're not totally sure about this limiting factor for this life stage, do we think it's a high priority for further research, or a low priority for further research, or we know enough about it already, even though we don't know everything? And that might be that we know enough to be able to start taking action, or it might be we know enough to know we don't need to take action. As with the scoring matrix here, there's an option for unsure. So if you're sitting here and you're really just unable to provide a score or know what your take is on a particular limiting factor for a particular life history phase, please just feel free to click unsure. It's better to go through this survey and complete it with some unsureness than to be sort of blocked from doing the survey at all. And so then there's two long answer questions here. So this gives you an opportunity to type some in the boxes here, and it provides a bit more qualitative information. So something we've heard time and again throughout this risk assessment process is that limiting factors don't exist in isolation. They usually have an interactive or a cumulative effect. And inherently, in trying to be able to put this process together and trying to be able to do a ranking process, we have to separate out these limiting factors conceptually. But here's an opportunity for you to input for this particular limiting factor. Here, limiting factor 12, this is to do with nutritional quality. What other sort of factors might this interact with? Whether that's temperature or salinity or anything you might want to put in the chat, then there's an opportunity to not the chat, this answer box. There's an opportunity for you to do that here. There's sort of an other thoughts question. So if you have further thoughts, if nothing in the above scoring matrix all the way down to this interactive question, sort of gives you an opportunity to put some context in that you think is important, this question here gives you that opportunity. So please take the opportunity to use these long answer questions in some of the previous surveys. There's been a lot of really good information, really good context, and that factors into we're working to collect all of these information, and it helps further our understanding and the product of this risk assessment. And so I mentioned that all this scoring so far is for marine life history phase one. That's that first summer at sea after out-migration to the ocean. The next life history phase is the first winter. So that next time, there's a strong hypothesis that this might be where a lot of the mortality happens, but there's a lot of people who disagree with that. And so the next part of this survey is really to just copy those five questions that we did for marine life history phase one. We're just doing the exact same five questions for marine life history phase two. So here's your scoring matrix. That's for the spatial, temporal impact and trends, the confidence and the priority for further research, and then our two long answer interactive and further thoughts. And then this is just repeated for my marine life history phase three. That's that rearing in the ocean environment before the homeward migration. And then life history phase four is the homeward migration to Needle Stream. And then all the way down at the bottom, we have one other question here, which is the above it would be too much to ask everybody to do all of this for both hatchery and wild fish. And for a lot of this, we don't have the information to make that distinction. But where we do, or where there's an ability to make a conjecture on that, we're just asking that let's consider these above rankings are for wild fish, that the focus of this risk assessment is in addressing and rebuilding that wild population. So the above rankings are for wild fish. Based on your knowledge and the presentations in the workshop, what would be the relative risk to hatchery fish for this factor? So maybe it's there's actually some reason why this is a greater risk for hatchery fish or a lesser risk, or it's just about the same. There's no way to make a distinction. So that's what these forms look like. So there's going to be one for each limiting factor, and we'll spend the rest of the morning today going through this with you. If you've participated in the freshwater risk assessment processes for West Coast Vancouver Island or elsewhere before, we've done this as a very collaborative discussion-based process. Today we don't really have the time, and there's probably too many people to be able to do that effectively. So we're going to hope to have some discussion on each of these, but as we fill them out, I'll keep this screen up, and we'll go through each of these surveys together with you. But feel free to move on ahead if you're like, nah, I know what I'm doing. I'm going to move forward. I'm going to go fast. And if not, feel free to follow along and get this done. Any questions on the process? And were all of you able to get the form that I emailed out and Critty put in the chat that has the links to each of these surveys? Maybe first, if anybody does not know where or how to access these surveys, please speak up right now or put something in the chat. We can direct you there. Okay. Seems like most people know how to find these. Perfect. Okay. Okay, a few people haven't found it.
Maybe walk through it.
Let's just put a direct link in the chat.
Maybe we walk through it.
That's the easiest thing to do.
It's just linked in the chat there. I just
you just click on that PDF, and then Tim can walk through, kind of navigate it.
Sure. So this is the PDF, or it's the Word document for the PDF that Critty put in the chat. First things first.